morning, ladies and gentlemen, to this very early morning session, but a very, very important session. Today I'm the chairperson for this session, and my name is Dr. Badar Assam, and I'm the advisor to the Assistant Director General for Health System and Service in WHO, and I'm leading WHO activities on health systems and global health initiatives, that interaction, which is very, very, very much relevant to this session that we'll be looking at the interaction, the synergies, possible synergies between health systems and global health initiatives. Everybody knows that there have been, over the last months and years, some debate on basically how mutually reinforcing can be the global health initiative and health system. And there is more and more evidence that global health initiatives, such as the PEPFAR program, the Global Fund program, the World Map program, the World Bank Map program, can reinforce health system. But also there's evidence that health systems in its classical way can be shaped in such a way that they can support global health initiatives so that they can achieve their primary goal, but also contribute to strengthening health system. In this session today, we'll be hearing several experts coming from different parts of the world, but also with different background and different view, showing that interaction that can exist between health system and global health initiative. So we have a session that is scheduled to end at 10:15. So we have some time. And we also have some time for the presentations to be made. Basically, each presentation will be lasting 15 minutes. And we have around six presentations. What I would, the way I would like to structure this session is that to allow each speaker to make his presentation or her presentation. If there is a pressing question, we can take them. But I would allow more discussion at the end of all these sessions so that we can interact with each other. And I think it will be even easier because we are not very, very many in this room. So I will not delay any further the core of this session, which is those very, very interesting presentation with very much original data. And I will start by calling upon Caroline Ryan from PEPFAR to come and make the first presentation that is entitled PEPFAR Contribution to Health System Strengthening Within the Context of the HIV Treatment. So, Caroline, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sam, and thank you to the organizers for the opportunity to speak this morning. And that's not working. Okay. All right, so why is TB-HIV a health systems issue? Certainly, there's many challenges in terms of what are the facilities available, the manpower available, laboratory monitoring and evaluation, communications and collaborations between national TB programs and national AIDS control programs. And then, as always, it's a question of resources. So I'm going to speak on several of these issues. So for those of you who are not aware what PEPFAR is, let me just tell you that initially when it was announced by President Bush in the State of the Union address in 2003, it was envisioned as a five-year, $15 billion comprehensive approach to fighting HIV and AIDS around the world. And that was to be a partnership with international, national, and local leaders worldwide, and it was to be an integrated program of prevention, treatment, and care. By the end of 2008, we will have invested about $18.8 billion, so we did get appropriated more money than the original authorization. Now, luckily for us, on July 30th, 2008, President Bush did sign into law the reauthorization of PEPFAR, and it's a $48 billion project, but now to fight three diseases, $39 billion for HIV, which is for PEPFAR and the Global Fund, $4 billion for bilateral programs to fight tuberculosis, and $5 billion for the malaria initiative. I do want to point out something, that this is an authorization. This is not an appropriation. So it's not clear how much money in this economic environment will actually be appropriated. Many people think of PEPFAR as a 15 focus countries, but actually it's over 162 programs. And you can see the focus countries in red, but the entire programs, including the bilateral, which are in blue, is on this worldwide map. just give you a few results. Through March of 2008, there's been PMTCT programs for women during 12.7 million pregnancies, antiretroviral prophylaxis for women for more than a million pregnancies, prevention of an estimated 194,000 infant infections, and antiretroviral treatment for 1.64 million people, and we anticipate that we will reach the 2 million target mark by the end of the program. We only do our care reporting on an annual basis, but as of September 30th, there was care for about 6.6 million people, including 2.7 orphans, and 33 million counseling and testing sessions. What has been the investments to date in TB? TB-HIV is a priority program for PEPFAR, and the support for these programs has increased almost 700% during the 4 years. There was $18.8 million in 2005, and in 2008, the investments in specific TB-HIV programs was $169 million. But we do actually support TB-HIV throughout all our other programs as well, not just TB-HIV. We try to have it integrated across all the technical areas. And as of September 2007, the numbers are being worked out with WHO as well, but approximately 367 TB-HIV co-infected people were served in the 15 focus countries. Now, one of the keystones of PEPFAR has been building capacity, and especially local capacity. And it's estimated that the network development, human resources, and local organization capacity development training in 2007, there were about $640 million allocated for those kinds of activities. That means that we partnered in 2008 with 2,217 local organizations, which was up from 2004, which was an 87% which means that 87% of our partners are actually local partners. We've provided $321 million to support training activities, and in FY08 it will be $309. And a preliminary evaluation of the Rwandan Ministry of Health found that 40% of PEPFAR resources in-country were devoted to general health systems. We've also partnered with WHO and UNAIDS to develop and launch the first ever normative guidance for task shifting to assist countries to expand the workforce. And in April of 2008, the U.S. and the U.K. announced a partnership between PEPFAR and DFID and the Ministries of Health of Ethiopia, Kenya, Mozambique, and Zambia to increase the number of healthcare workers that provide essential services that include HIV/AIDS and also interventions to reduce maternal mortality. In 2008, PEPFAR supported 2.7 million training encounters and salaries for over 110,000 healthcare workers. And in the 2009 COPS country operational plans, there is now the opportunity to use $6 million, or 3% of your total PEPFAR country budget, to support long-term pre-service training of new health professionals. And it's worth noting that as one of the earmarks in the new legislation, PEPFAR is required to support the training of 140,000 new healthcare workers. We're also working to insert language into contracts and grant agreements with large international partners that requires them to turn over programs to local partners that will further support indigenous capacity. And now through what we're calling partnership compacts, which will now be the main vehicle for support in the next phase of PEPFAR, we're working with host governments, civil society, and other international partners to strengthen both the system's capacity and implement policy changes such as task shifting that will help the health workforce capacity. Now, what's been some of the impact outcomes of this kind of investment? We've noticed in the Secure the Future program that the HIV mortality has been reduced from 25% to 13%, and a reduction in the hospital bed occupancy from 93% to 52% between 2004 and 2006. In Uganda, in a rural setting in eastern Uganda, with ART and clean water being delivered by lay healthcare workers, there's been a 95% reduction in HIV/AIDS mortality, an 81% reduction in non-HIV infant mortality, and a 93% reduction in orphanhood. And this is a busy slide, but the take-home message is that this is a study that Family Health International did at 30 primary healthcare centers in Rwanda, and examined 22 non-health indicators, non-HIV health indicators, and what was the impact of the HIV program on these other indicators. And only one indicator declined while there was an improvement in, and a significant improvement in 15 of the other indicators, such as new family planning users, returning family planning users, ANC visits, and syphilis screening. Also, in the same sites, they found that those programs that had ART therapy for more than 2 months had an average decrease in new hospitalizations about 21%. In a study done by John Blanford and colleagues at CDC of 33 supported PEPFAR sites that provide antiretroviral therapy, and I'll show you some more data on this, PEPFAR supported 92% of the system strengthening in the typical facility. This just gives you an idea of the type of renovations that occur at the primary health care level and also supporting new facilities. So let me get back to John's study. This was a public health evaluation that looked at the estimates of costs for comprehensive HIV treatment. It was done by John Blanford from CDC in collaboration with Macro International and USAID. And they looked at a total of 45 HIV treatment facilities across 5 countries, Nigeria, Uganda, Ethiopia, Botswana, and Vietnam. And what they were trying to do was estimate the annual per-person cost of providing comprehensive HIV treatment to adults and pediatric patients. They also wanted to understand what are the factors that influence overall and component costs and how these factors vary across countries and facilities, and also by program maturity. And what this shows you is that the median percentage of HIV total costs supported by U.S. government. So within these facilities, overall 86% of overall costs for HIV treatment were funded through this program. So PEPFAR supported the major part of the investment. So what were those investments? They were laboratory and other equipment, facility renovations, and new infrastructure, in-service training of healthcare. There also was... These costs then were front-loaded, so they represented initially the largest share of a per-patient costs in the early part of a program. But what you'll see now is that the per-patient costs rapidly decline as you have upfront investments and also as you get economies of scale with patient volume. So in the green line are the pre-ART patients, and in the yellow line are the established ART patients, and the blue line are new ART patients. And what you can see over time is the decline per patient cost as the program matures. And as I said, that's a function of the upfront cost for training and equipment and also the economy of scales as the programs mature. Let me just show you where those costs are. So you can see, it's a little bit hard to see, but in the bottom part of in yellow, you'll see something that says equipment and infrastructure 28% and training 5%. So about a third of the cost in the first 6 months of the program is spent on infrastructure and training. That goes down to 9% as you have more mature programs, and the bulk of the program's costs now are drugs. So during this period of time, the mean of 76% of all investments were for building infrastructure, equipment, and training at the site. This just gives you an idea of what percentage of the different activities were funded. Now, I'm not going to say too much about SCMS or supply chain management because I believe we have another speaker on that, but another part of the health system strengthening has been the establishment of both logistics and procurement programs, which also have regional distribution centers, and we'll be hearing more about that. Now, what are some of the strategies to address the human resources for health shortages? One that has been incentives to attract and retrain healthcare workers. That includes a variety of things, such as in-service training, housing, development opportunities, subsidy fees for school, hardship pay, transportation, utilization of underemployed and retired healthcare workers, such as expanded hiring, contracting, in-service training, and then scaling up and adjusting the mix of pre-service training. Let me just give you a few examples. In Kenya, we've been supporting the government's emergency hiring plan, which trains and employs retired physicians, nurses, and other healthcare workers for the private sector, and so far 830 were deployed in 2007. In Zambia, there's a rural retention scheme that provides incentives such as hardship allowances, housing, transportation, educational stipends for children of physicians that serve in rural areas. In Namibia and Mozambique, through contracting mechanisms, newly qualified healthcare workers are hired on a short-term basis to allow the Ministry of Health until they can bring them into the public service. And then in Tanzania, there's a program called Retired But Not Yet Tired program, which brings back retired healthcare workers to work in the health force. There's also building capacity through developing new cadres of healthcare workers. In South Africa, there's now curriculum and a training for a new cadre of clinical officers. In Nigeria, they're looking to train nurses to provide ART and PMCT in the home. In Ethiopia, there's a very interesting program that supports 300,000 or 30,000 new community health care workers and 5,000 clinical officers. And so far, 18,000 of these clinical community health care workers have been trained and deployed. And in Vietnam, they're working to develop addiction specialists and case managers that will support medication-assisted therapy for intravenous drug users. One of the keys, I think, has been task shifting and looking at nurse-based management for HIV care and ART. That means shifting services from doctors to nurses and a whole different categories of nurses, whether it's nurse clinicians, professional nurses, or nursing assistants. It means intensified theoretical and on-site training, as well as now nurse-oriented guides and tools. And this is a study that's done by Joyce Chung that looks at what before there was task shifting in Rwanda and after task shifting in Rwanda. There are about 150 clinicians in Rwanda, and what they found was that 77% of their time was on managing antiretroviral and other care for HIV-positive patients. When they were able to do task shifting, it only took 17 full-time physicians now to be able to supply the same type of care, and that freed up physicians to do more of the specialty care and difficult cases. What has been the outcome of nurses task shifting to ART, there had been some concerns that maybe they had not would not perform as well, but actually they're performing very well. In a study that was done by Shumbushio, they looked to see how well the nurses did, 487 nurses, and what they found was that none of the patients started in ART were not eligible, and only 4.2% who did not start were eligible. So they should have had a control group of doctors, but I'm sure they might have not as performed as well. But this is very, very well-performing group. So task shifting is part of the response to the crisis of the healthcare workforce, and it is part of a long-term solution, but it's a zero-sum game. So there's a cost to shifting responsibilities and providers to other providers, and all of these healthcare workers are still overstretched. Supervision and mentoring is essential, and there's a need for more pre-service training to find more healthcare workers. But there is a caution here. Sometimes I think that we say task shifting the solution to all of our healthcare force problems, and task shifting alone cannot solve all these problems. It's going to be pre-service training and more resources. There also is a need to make sure that we protect those healthcare workers that we have. So there is a need for improving infection control in high HIV-TB settings and making sure that there's masks for all staff and state-of-the-art ventilation in facilities. So what are the opportunities for HIV-TB health system strengthening? First, establishment of an HR task force, embracing task shifting as a key national policy for nurses and lay counselors, developing retention schemes for all health staff, including funding of lay counselors, considering accreditation for lay counselors, creating wellness centers for health workers, developing occupational safety plan to protect work healthcare staff and other patients, leveraging health facilities and community workers to do both HIV and TB activities. Right now we have community workers for TB and community workers for HIV. We should try to leverage and integrate these programs. Leveraging lab facilities to improve TB and HIV diagnostics, including the transportation of specimens. And then there's a need to engage community. There needs to be meaningful involvement of the affected communities at all level, including decision-making levels. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Caroline, for this very, very clear presentation. And also, so we congratulate you for the data and PEPFAR for the good data that you are now showing, very original data, and showing, probably enlightening the debate about the possible positive impact of global health initiative on health systems. Unless there is a very, very pressing question that one or two people would like to ask to Caroline, I would like then to move to the next presentation. So since I am not hearing, seeing any hand waving over there, I would like to introduce the next presentation. In her presentation, Caroline mentioned that WHO and PEPFAR has launched new sets of policy guidelines that look at task shifting. And I think people have been looking at, she has been giving very, very good data about task shifting, how it has been effective in leveraging doctors to, of course, in saving times of doctors to deal with other conditions than HIV. In this room, we have Wesley Lambert. Wesley Lambert is from Haiti, and he has been very, very much involved in generating such evidence, and he has real country experience on what task shifting is in Haiti. So at this juncture, I will just give to him the floor to talk about task shifting in Haiti. So Wesley, you have the floor. Yeah, he will definitely need to. Can we have somebody to help? And he's coming. Can you please help me to go to the next presentation? Thank you so much. And Wesley Lambert is working in the Central Plateau in Haiti with an organization called Partners in Health. And Partners in Health has been looking at community intervention, real facility intervention, and recently Partners in Health has benefited from grant from the Global Fund, but also from grant from PEPFAR, and has been able. And today, the work that they have been doing in Haiti is more and more quoted as best practices on how a program that is designed to address TB, to address HIV, to address malaria can actually strengthen health system. I don't know what kind of data he will be presenting to us. But it's not yet already there.
Okay,
it's becoming.
So we're still waiting for.
But Haiti is really being seen as a model example. Of course, when we talk about Haiti, it does not mean that what's happening in Haiti can be just transposed, can be replicated elsewhere. So we will have to look at your presentation, your data in the context of your country. But there are certainly some aspect of the strategies that you have been implementing that can be adapted to other countries. I think today, as we are waiting for the technology to be fixed, we are now having more and more information on the real positive effect of global health initiatives such as the PEPFAR on health system. And I think we have now compelling evidence, at least as far as PEPFAR is concerned, that there is a positive impact of global health system on health system. I think now the question will be, what are the system design, what are the health system design that have been put in place to allow those positive synergies? And that will certainly be the basis of any policy or technical guidance that WHO or other international organization may have to basically try to have a better and a best use of those global health initiatives. I was very, very much impressed by the 700% increase of scale-up of TB services within such a short period of time. Very much also impressed by how task shifting has been able to to use more efficiently the time of doctor. So, yeah, if you have some time.
Thanks for your question, Ruben. Well, I think, first of all, the data that shows how effectively the nurses were able to determine eligibility for ART, I found very, very helpful. And I really wish there was like a U.S. physician comparison, because it may not be as good. So I think we may overestimate the complexity or the of some of these things. But I think the question really is, how much can you ask one person to do? And in the context of task forcing, do you overburden people? So resources are also needed. It's not just a question of task shifting. It's additional healthcare workers as well.
Thank you, Caroline. Now, Wesley, you have the floor. We look forward to your country experience in Haiti and task shifting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. It's my pleasure this morning to talk about the task shifting approach in PIHM programs. In 2006, WHO commissioned a study on task shifting in several countries severely affected by the shortage of healthcare workers. And the study was looking at the current practice of task shifting in these countries, but also looking at the outcomes of programs using task shifting and the perception and attitudes of the staff and the patient. So Partners in Health, which is a major NGO, to initiate ART in rural settings in Rwanda and Haiti was invited to participate. Some facts about Partners in Health. Partners in Health is a non-profit organization working now in 10 different countries in America, in the Caribbean, in Africa, and Eastern Europe. Partners in Health programs seek to deliver healthcare to the most in need. And at PIH, at Partners in Health, we see healthcare as a comprehensive issue that is closely associated with socioeconomic conditions of patients. And Partners in Health promotes community-based programs within the context of primary health care and with collaboration with the Ministry of Health. So I want to show some recent data about Haiti, about the human resources in Haiti. Haiti has 8 million people for an HIV prevalence of 2.9. The HIV prevalence went down from 6% to 2.9 during the last 10 years. A recent assessment of the health care workers in Haiti found only 2,422 doctors and 3,000 nurses. There are only 251 pharmacists and 234 technologists. But within the country, there's an unequal distribution of the personnel. So in the central part, for example, for 650,000 people, there's only 2% of all the staff. There's only 70 doctors, 120 nurses, but 2,500 community health workers. If we look back to the past, in 1998, when Partners in Health started its HIV program in the central region of Haiti, for 500,000 people, there was only 12 doctors, 2 pharmacists, and 15 nurses. Just imagine how hard it will be to scale up ART with so limited staff. So in 2008, PIH is following more than 3,500 people on ART in Haiti, in the central region, and more than 14,000 HIV patients. Now we have, as I pointed out before, 2,500 community health workers. I want to mention Wanda because the study involved Wanda as well. In 2005, Partners in Health started a pilot World Health model in Wanda in partnership with the Clinton Foundation and the government of Wanda. We found similar situation for the human resources for health in Wanda. But now, the Inshuti Mubuzima follows more than 2,000 patients on ART. They have trained and hired more than 800 villagers as community health workers. So let's talk about the mapping study in Haiti. The objective was to document the clinical practice at Partners in Health sites, and it was part of a larger comprehensive mapping by WHO, OGAC, Institute of Venture Partners, including Rwanda, Ethiopia, Malawi, and Uganda. Questionnaires using a mix of qualitative and quantitative methods were administered to the health workers, and 135 tasks were identified in HIV care. So this is the traditional distribution of HIV-related clinical care tasks. It showed the burden of the task to the doctors and less to the nurses. And this is what the study found in Haiti. There was a clear shift of tasks from doctors to nurses and mostly to community health workers. In this study, nurses reported that 92%, more than 92% of all the tasks, all 135 tasks, and community health workers, nurses and doctors perform around 40% of all the tasks. So the accompagnator makes the largest group of community health workers. They are key members of the healthcare facility, and as I said before, they perform more than 40% of all these tasks. So they represent what we call the cornerstone of our HIV program, and they make the link between the communities and the clinics. What do we consider as community health workers? It's a large variety of local people, formally and informally trained to perform specific tasks. They are health agents. People are used to health agents. They can be counselors, lab technicians, pharmacy technicians, and social worker assistants, and data clerks. So using task shifting as a major strategy to respond to the human resources crisis in Haiti, the program has shown good results. An evaluation of the first Global Fund cohort in Haiti found that less than 1% of the total cohort switched to the second line of ART. 90% survival at 12 months of ART, and the default rate was less than 5% at 24 months. And a preliminary evaluation of our PMTT program in 2006 showed there's a 2% transmission rate of HIV from mother to children. And in Haiti, despite significant political instability in 2004 and recent floodings in 2008, not a single patient missed ART doses. So as a complement to the study, we surveyed 200 HIV patients, asking them about their confidence in the quality of care they were receiving. So 96% of them reported that they were very confident about the quality of care they received. And 96% of them even said they are very satisfied with the communication they have with the nurses. So question remains, Is this program scalable and sustainable? It's, people always ask such questions to our colleagues in working at PIH. So PIH has been in Haiti for 20 years now. They started in 1987, and they're still there. And after a request from the Ministry of Health, the program was scaled up from the central region to the Artibonite. The Artibonite region makes twice the size of the population of the central plateau. It has 1 million people. And the program was scaled up also from Haiti to Rwanda. And from a pilot project in Rwanda, it's been made now as a national model. And it was also scaled up to Peru, Lesotho, Malawi, and Boston. So that shifting to committee F workers is just one of many strategies to address the human resources crisis. And it requires more significant financial effort and salaries for more staff. Committee F workers are the key elements of PIH and task shifting approach, and they are seen as formal members of the health systems. People living with HIV/AIDS are actively recruited, and priority is given to this group every time they meet the requirements for a specific position. And it's very important to mention that using such approach, PIH has built local capacity and create new jobs. So our experience led us to consider several key issues when it comes to task shifting and to care in general. Safety and quality of care, they should be of paramount importance. Supervision, training, and motivation should be seen as essential and mandatory, and they help also ensure the quality and safety. If you are really serious about strengthening the health system, the Ministry of Health should be at the central, should play a central role, a key role. PIH intervention are implemented in close collaboration with the Ministry of Health in any country where we work. And primary care should be free and encouraged to be the entry point for further care. Task shifting cannot be successful without a functional referral system, and free care should be part of these strategies if we really want to serve the poorest. As we push for more use of task shifting as a means to respond to the human resources crisis in many countries affected by the healthcare workforce shortage, we need to anticipate the increase in the service use. Task shifting should not be seen as a cost-cutting strategy, as the total numbers of healthcare workers will increase, and I think that was the objective of this initiative. Task shifting exists as a successful model for scale-up of HIV in Haiti and Rwanda, with good outcomes and low rates of abandonment. Where human resources for health are limited, task shifting from doctors to nurses and community health workers may be undertaken as a strategy for rationally distributing human resources. Shifting tasks to community health workers provides additive benefits, providing essential services such frequent adherence and psychosocial support. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Wesley, for this very, very good presentation, and of course the experience of Haiti, which I personally had the opportunity to visit, and very, very interesting. I'm sure that everybody has noticed one of the sentences that Wesley said, that the experience of Haiti has been basically replicated to a few number of cities or countries, including Boston, and that was quite interesting as a remark. So, and it's not very, very usual that way, so it was very interesting to hear that. I'm sure many people have questions for you, Wesley, but since we are in the task shifting, and the next presentation will be also on task shifting, I would just want to delay any question to Wesley to at least the following presentation. talking about task shifting, it's talking about touching the scope of practice of different practitioners, looking at the scope of practice of doctors, looking at the scope of practice of nurses, and trying to see how some task of doctors can be shifted to nurses, or from some task of nurses can be shifted to community healthcare workers. But when we touch scope of practice, we are touching something that is very, very much regulated at country level. At country level, a nurse has some function, a doctor has some function. And here we see that in Haiti, some functions that are basically the task of doctors have been shifted. So that needs some regulations at country level, because if there is something that an organization does not want to do, is to transform some practitioners into outlaws. So that's the issue that will be addressed in the next presentation by Elizabeth Madra, who will look at the Uganda example and other examples, and look at that regulatory framework that should accompany task shifting. Elizabeth is certainly one of the oldest and the more experienced program managers, HIV program managers, and she comes also from a country, which is Uganda, which is known as a very, very successful country when it comes to disease control, and more especially HIV control. So it's my pleasure to introduce my very good friend, Elizabeth, to make the next presentation. Elizabeth, the floor is for you.
Thank you, Sam, for that introduction. I'd like also to apologize for my voice. I seem to be catching cold. I'll begin my presentation by showing this book here. I should have scanned and make it clearer, but I got it a little bit late when the presentation was already made. This is the global, I would say, the recommendation guidelines, which was developed with support from PEPFAR and WHO for guiding countries on task shifting. And it was launched this year in Addis. And this was attended by very many key people, including government representatives, who were represented particularly by their health ministers, because this is a sector which is very key in oversight when it comes to country level, how these guidelines and recommendations are supposed to be used. Also, partners who at the country level are often forgotten, but they are very key, like the paramedicals, professional associations, the institutions of high learning, the private sector, the civil society organizations, especially people living with HIV and AIDS. All these people were invited at this meeting. And this meeting took place just about 2 or 3 months before the bigger meeting, which took place in Uganda on I think it was the health, human resource for health, which took place in Uganda. And it was also well attended. And that's where I think the synergy, which Dr. Sab Badara is really talking about. I've been asked to talk about the regulatory framework. And the regulatory framework in countries definitely vary. And that's why this was recommended, developed, and it used all the rules really required for developing guidelines in WHO. I've been part of development of this guideline. I've never seen such a strict regulation in developing process. It was even subjected to peer review, to critics, before finally we made it available for recommendation. Even at the recommendation level, when we met in Addis, there was quite a lot of argument among the African ministers. Should we take this or should we not? What about the green card? What about the blue card? Everybody wanted to talk about the shifting of human resource from countries to Europe, even within countries, from government to NGO and all that. But then, of course, we said there has to be a start. The fact is that we have a problem, a gap in the human resource. So what I looked at was what is needed in terms of regulatory framework to adopt these guidelines and recommendations. It need not involve extensive changes in policy and legislation. The process may vary from country to country. because each country has its own, but then there's a lot of similarities which can still be used. Some countries may already have sufficient scope to implement task shifting within their existing proclamations or their rules, their regulations, and then also the guidelines. The degree of regulation required will vary depending on the types of task shifting, already mentioned earlier here in the presentation by Lambert. The task shifting later you see in my presentation, they vary, the degree vary. Some people may want to go with the first two, others may want to go with everything, depending on the situation they have in the country. Regulatory approaches may range also from the level. It could be within government, also non-governmental organization, or within the professional association, because there are quite a number of people rendering health services. And this is just because of the HIV/AIDS burden that we see the increase in the human resource gap. And indeed, the drive to increase human resource gap now merges up with the other diseases like TB, malaria, and you could see how this is really very important in terms of strengthening also the systems we are talking about. So who are the responsible people we look at? Those who are responsible could be the controlling scope of practice. We have a cadre who are looking at that, disciplinary action, who provides that and all that. Determining standards of good practice. We looked here at the issue of safety and quality. And then monitoring the contacts of the service providers. Many people complain at times the health workers are rude. That's why people don't go to the hospital. And all sorts of accusations which are happening. And then we also look to the, provide guidance also to legislators and administrators how this really should do indeed happen. The degree of regulation required may depend on the types of the task shifting, as I mentioned already. In a number of high-income countries, there are already examples of nurses who have extended to include their prescription as a routine medication. That's happened in some countries. And then, of course, people living with HIV and AIDS have also shown in a country like mine, Uganda, can be empowered also to manage their own conditions to support others. We have a lot of community initiatives at home, which is happening. We have also people who are being given their medication, ART, at home, the home-based management of the ART, and this is being done by the sick people themselves. And there are those who monitor their own friends for adherence. This is already happening. They are managing themselves. And, of course, in some resource-constrained countries, people living with HIV and AIDS, they've been trained to deliver services originally designed to be delivered by doctors or specialist nurses. They're also often supported by the community health workers. There are many examples which were done, actually, before this guideline was developed. A lot of studies were done in these countries, Uganda, Malawi, Ethiopia. Haiti was one of them, and then later others, which is really to find what basically is happening in the countries themselves. These are the different types of task shifting. Because before a regulatory framework has to be studied at the country level, you need to know what are those responsibilities being shifted. Are they the easy ones? Are they the difficult ones? Are they what the nurses can do? Are they what the doctors can do or the clinical officers? So the extension of scope of the practice to non-physician and the clinician would be done in the task shifting one. Some of you already know this. This is just a recap. And then the task shifting two, which basically look at extension of scope of work of nurses, midwives, from the medical doctors or to the non-physician clinicians. These terms also change. Others call them medical assistants, others clinical officers. It really varies from country to country. And then, of course, task shifting number three, extending scope of work to community health workers, people living with HIV and AIDS, and then also tasks previously performed by nurses, midwives, and non-physicians. And the task shifting number four, people living with HIV and AIDS who have been trained in self-management, they assume tasks related to their own care previously undertaken by health workers. Regulatory framework can also address all this depending on the country-specific situation. Others can say, no, we don't want this, we want to leave it to the number two. The implementation of the recommendation and guidelines on the task shifting, now, it will depend on the current shortage of human resources. We say there has to be a plan, a human resource strategic plan. The countries would know what is the gap, where are the gaps, which facilities need to be staffed more. Now we are all talking of PHC. Primary health care level will be at the lower facility level, and that's where you need more of the human resource. and then the need for scale-up health services, including HIV services. We were talking of HIV earlier because of the demand, but now that can't be spread from the other health service delivery. Caring for TB, caring for malaria, this can all be done at an integrated. So the implementation of the recommendations, there are five key areas that require country-specific adaptation of the regulatory framework to support successful national implementation of the task shifting. These are involvement of the stakeholders. Now we are at the country level, and it is the countries which are going to adopt these guidelines and recommendations for implementation. If it fails, then it is at the country level. And that's why at the country level, we need to work with the stakeholders, basically the councils. The regulatory framework are the councils, the national councils, the ministries of public service, this is the MOPS. Finance, we are talking of finance because when we do task shifting, it does not mean there won't be money, resources attached to it. The people who are taking over are likely to have responsibilities more than what they did earlier, maybe, and in that case, they will need maybe increase of salaries from what they earned previously. And then those who were training more to come in may also require that. That's why this Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Public Service, because many countries deal with government, and public service is recruiting body. And then associations, the CBOs, that is the community-based organization, NGO education institution. The key stakeholders will determine the roles of the new cadre. The new cadre are those we are training, giving new responsibilities to take over tasks they've not performed before, but they can do it through training. And these are created or specifically trained cadres in relation to the existing providers. And then certification of providers is regulated by the Medical and the Nurses Council. You train somebody who is to take over these responsibilities. You need now to have a regulatory framework by the council, the Nurses Council, the Midwife Council. They can reject. And that's why we're looking, and many of these councils had policies, regulatory framework, some 10, 20 years back, which have never been reviewed. We are now talking of task shifting. They need to go back and look at these regulatory frameworks. The use of certification or practice requirements are negotiated between the Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, professional association, and regulatory councils. And this can apply to any of the task shifting, either one or two, as I've already indicated earlier. Training curriculum is responsibility of Ministry of Education and National Council of Higher Education. How are they going to look at this? How do we adopt this with the training? Because we are shifting tasks, but we need also to train more who are coming in. We need to go to pre-service training. We need to go for in-service training. So those curriculum need to be standardized, and this group will be very important. Resource availability. We shall need funds for this. Ministries of Finance, the Parliament, and the donors should contribute resources to accommodate the new task-shifting patterns and members. Provision of appropriate technical assistance is crucial. And this is what would be put as a recommendation to country office, WHO, to donors' agencies. PEPFAR is talking of task-shifting. The World Bank, MAP project. If it is, then let us put money into that. The process of adapting this regulatory framework. Some task shifting is already happening. It is not new. But then you will need funds to be put into it to see it rolled through. So labor issues, which is relevant to task shifting, too, need to be factored, given the training and the scope of work, which are limited to the same nursing practice. In Malawi, when the nurses, by Parliament Act, were allowed to prescribe and all that, their responsibilities increase, and I'm told that they form a union. And that union means that looking at the labor laws and all that, what will affect their functionality as taking up new tasks. Integration with the other basic health service cadres, such as pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, technologists, could all be included in a task-shifting approach. When we did this, the pharmacists were earlier not on board. And through the peer review, we got criticism on inclusion of the pharmacists. And fortunately, towards the end, that was also done. Training of health workers to improve quality of service. Organizing health service delivery to include changes of practice and creation of new health. Cadres of health workers, which may not be consistent with existing national regulation. That pertain to the previous health workers and those they serve. And that is usually what happens. When we visit our regulatory framework, we see with the changes we are making, is this consistent with that? Should it go ahead with that, or should we revisit all that again? The Addis Ababa ministers came with the declaration. I only picked number 10. There were about 12 of them, which says call on countries to adapt and to implement the WHO global recommendations and guidelines where appropriate, according to the specific circumstances of individual countries, and develop national action plans. This was very key. The national action plan needs to look at the human resource gap and the staffing norms. For the implementation of task shifting with national human resource policy strategies and budgets, that can ensure quality and effectiveness of essential health service contributing to the strengthening of health systems. This came from the health ministers themselves. So, what will be the way forward for regulatory framework adaptation to support the task shifting? National governments and partners should start the implementation of the recommendation and guidance on task shifting. Ministries of Health should use the existing legal authority to initiate the interpretation of laws, policies affecting the health sector. And this is done to accommodate the task shifting guidelines recommendation. The constitution may vary, of course, from country to country. There are three main branches of the national government who are key in the adaptation of the regulatory framework, and I think this applies to all countries. The legislature, which is the parliament, the executive, that is the president, the cabinet, and the ministers, and then the judiciary. And of course, the approaches can be shorter. It can be very immediate. It can take even longer. But here we are dealing with an emergency. We may go for the first immediate one, and then later on regularize this into the system, which can then be used for a long time. Somebody was asking us, this guideline, for how long are we going to implement it? Is it 2 years? Is it 3 years? I think that will be within the country if we are going to do the regulatory framework and see how we are going to accept this. The short immediate, we could look at the medical and dental practitioners statute, which we all have, allied health professionals, nurses and midwives, and the National Pharmaceutical Act. What does it say? What can change to make this immediate so that the new cadre we are bringing in training with the task shifting various level I'd already mentioned, we see how we could accommodate this. Once we review this, the ministers of health can take it to cabinet, cabinet takes it to parliament, and can be approved. Then these steps may vary again, and we can use this immediately, and people will start doing it. But task shifting is happening. Not formally. Here we are doing it because we want to protect the service provider, we want to also protect the recipient. That is the. As a long term, this is what we are going to accept if it is accepted throughout this. The countries may be required to review or develop human resource strategic plan and the current based on their current needs. They can review the different acts to accommodate the new cadre, employment degrees, public service act, salaries, allowances. All these are going to come in. As we are saying, it is not the solution. The task shifting is not the solution. The biggest thing here is how do we maintain and retain even those who are training, those who are bringing in as new cadre, and then also satisfy their being where we are posting them. We could task shift, but if there's no retention scheme, there's no motivation, they will still leave. So we want to solve the problem at all. Workers' Compensation Act, all this need to be reviewed now, and the Labour Union Act, as I told you in Malawi, nurses form the union. So what is going to happen? We need to look at all these regulatory frameworks as a long term. And then, of course, who are the responsible sectors? Ministries of Health, Finance, Gender, Labor and Social Development, local government, because there are districts employing public service, and the Justice, Ministry of Justice again. Again, here, the ministers are the responsible people. On the task shifting, which goes again, everything has to be debated at the cabinet level, then it goes to parliament, finally it is approved. I'm talking basically within the resource-constrained countries, where we have a lot of those similarities in terms of adapting our regulatory framework. So, in conclusion, what I'll say is international development partners, WHO, UNAIDS, DFID, other donors, PEPFAR Global Fund, need to support countries to facilitate the process of the adaptation of regulatory framework to support task shifting. We are talking of human resource, and we've not found the money to retain our trained, skilled manpower. Countries definitely are losing quite a number out, and then also within the countries. And unless we give funds to support this document, we don't want them to remain on our shelves. And then also countries had been asked to go back with the support from the WHO country offices and other partners within the countries to start looking at this, and we implement the task shifting process, also done through the provision of appropriate technical assistance, which will definitely be needed. And where the countries need technical assistance, I think this should really be given. And finally, I thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for this well-sought and passionate debate. I would like you, Elizabeth, to stay here, and I will also ask Caroline and Wesley to join me on this table. And at this stage, I would like to open the first round of discussion of this presentation. Caroline, can you come here, please? Wesley, if you can just be over there, and I put myself in between two ladies. So, I would like, before we go to the other set of three presentations, to open the floor for 7 to 10 minutes discussion. So the floor now is up to you. If you have any question for which you would like to have answers, if you have some clarification that you would like to have from the presentation that have been made so far, the floor is for you. Any point of clarification? Yes? Okay, so we take one question. So maybe we can ask Elizabeth to kick off with an answer to that.
Actually, that's a very good question. Initiating task shifting, who initiated? Is it Minister of Health or... Let me give the background of the task shifting. With the demand currently for care for HIV and AIDS patients and other emerging illnesses, the task shifting has already been happening in countries. Even within government facilities, you see quite a number of people performing responsibilities which are not their own. And we've had non-governmental organizations who are already supplementing government effort, who have tried because they are much faster. Because within the government system, you could see the process you need to go through regulatory framework. And here people are dying, the demands were there. We've seen partner organizations who are already supporting our efforts train ACADA to support workforce within the service delivery facilities. And this was already happening. And was being accommodated. The only thing we saw, which was not easily done, was the registration of this trained cadre, like either a medical practitioner or a nurse practitioner. So from that level, at several meetings, our health ministers have complained of gaps in the human resource. At WHO, World Health Assembly, at the WHO, the health ministers meeting in Afro, and all this at every forum. So they were looking at a way, so how can they be best supported to address this issue of human resource gap? And you can't stop people from moving. People are all the time moving, it is their right. I think it is from that WHO took it as a mandate of the responsibilities to support countries, but they did not detect that, go and do this. We are already doing it at the country level, but we said let us work out a recommendation and a regulatory framework which is going to help in ensuring that these services which have been provided is of quality. And then in the process of the developing of the guideline is when we are streamlining. But at the country level, it was informally already happening. What we wanted now is security of the care provider and then the security also of the patient. So one way or the other, it is, I think, country-level initiative. And they cry at the country level, which now prompt something to be done, but not a prescription, a guideline. Now countries need to take it up whether they like it or they don't like it. That's why the regulatory framework has to be followed.
Thank you very, very much for this clarification. If Wesley or Caroline want to add on before you go to the next question. That's fine. So, next question. And please introduce yourself.
Ruben Granitz with the HIV department at WHO. So my question is actually about symptoms. seen some places where they have very simple standardized programs. I've seen other places where it's very, very complicated. So I was really wondering whether, even if you cash it, have any of the panelists thought about ways to make things simplified and moving towards, like, for example, the WHO patient monitoring tool and moving away from very complicated monitoring and evaluation systems, for example, and going towards simplification as part of, I guess, task minimization, not in a negative sense. So that's really my question.
Okay. I think I will probably give the floor to Wesley and Carolyn to reply to that. But before, I think there is another question that this lady wanted to ask. Can you please introduce yourself as well? Yeah.
Because they come with a little bit of motivation, then the government is not able to afford it, let alone sustain it, so it all dies away. So what are we doing about that? Then I was also worried about what Margaret said. She said, for example, if we just shift some duties from nurses and to other others, and the nurses take on more responsibilities, they will expect salary increments. If we do this, then I don't see what you're trying to say. Because what I'm thinking of is that we are saying what are these tasks that a nurse can do and what are those other tasks that a nurse, someone else could actually do. So in short, the work remains the same. So I don't expect people to be asking for more salary. That's okay.
Good. Thank you. I take another question.
What's happening in terms of simplifying care, what kinds of systems are being built for supervision or quality assurance when task shifting is happening? I think we see that often people go through an initial training, go out to the field, and then when you go out and visit them, they're still struggling a little bit. So when countries are doing task shifting, how is capacity being built? Who is responsible for making sure that the quality of services is not compromised as services are being delivered by lower cadres of staff?
Good. Very, very good sets of questions. Then I will now, at this point, hand over first to Wesley and second to Carolyn and, of course, to Elizabeth.
I will start by answering to the question of Dr. O'Reilly about the shifting of other tasks, not only HIV related. Like in our experience, it's not, as I said in my presentation, it's not only about HIV, it's about any kind of task. We have shift tasks from one cadre to another one, but we shift every kind of task. For example, maternal health. We shift us, you know, from midwives to community health workers and then to traditional birth attendants also, which is a cadre that we have not talked about, you know, it's so controversial. But also you mentioned that task shifting is expensive. Yes, it is expensive as we know we increase the total number of personnel. But also it's expensive in a way that all you need to motivate these cadres, it costs. And you talk also about end of program. Our experience is we always say that it's a long, we never say that it's, you know, our program will last like 6 years. We say it's a long-term commitment. And I think that it should be programs or NGOs should, you know, revise their, you know, their policy. And their, because when you start a program for, you know, when you implement a program for 2 years, what will happen after? But if you work closely with the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Health can take on these programs. There's a question also about salary increase for nurses. Yes, nurses with disability will increase, yes. But remember that some of nurses' tasks will be shifted to other community health workers or to nurse auxiliaries. But in all the categories will have their responsibility increased somewhat. And the issue of supervision and quality of care. We are in Haiti now, in Partners in Health program, not only in Haiti, but also in other PIH programs in other countries. We build a system for supervision from doctors to community health workers. Even within the network of community health workers, they have different kind of supervisors to ensure that we don't leave the, you know, the right path of, you know, quality of care, because people are concerned about, you know, substandard of care when it comes to community health workers. But if you have a very good system, I believe that it will work. In our experience, it worked in our experience. I hope that it will be the same for other programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Wesley. Caroline?
Yeah, let me briefly make a few points. First of all, I think we fully recognize the importance of standardized algorithms or criteria for implementing some of the task force activities, and we look to WHO for putting those forth and then adaptation at the country level. The second is that in terms of support supervision and ongoing support supervision in a program, I think that's where the importance of indicators are very important, so that we're monitoring programs as we're doing the task shifting to make sure that we're looking, there's still the same number of people who are adherent to both antiretrovirals, TB, and other things. So the interim indicators, I think, are very important. And then lastly, just to point out again the need for thinking outside of just task shifting, but thinking about the development of new cadres of healthcare workers, like what was done in Kenya, where they redefined the type of clinical officer, and then the need to invest in pre-service, not just in-service training. And that's one of the reasons why this year we've really tried to put into the country operational plans the opportunities for $6 million or 3% of your total budget on pre-service training, so people to have the opportunity to sort of rethink what are the healthcare needs.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. Elizabeth?
Yeah. There were questions. I think two came from, two were basically concerning simplification of tools and then making, also ensuring quality. I think if we didn't simplify the management of aid care, I don't think we would have reached even the number so far we have who are on antiretroviral treatment. In ideal world, you would first have to do the staging, you have to do the CD4, you have to do the viral load, and all this, of course, is not a simple one-day thing. And in that case, you have so many who need the care and treatment, and the majority of where expert diagnostic facilities are based are the regional referral, provincial, or the government hospitals. Now, if you think you should go lower to the primary health care level at the health facilities, you will not have that. So indeed, simplification of tools was the first thing as we decided to go universal access, scaling up care and treatment. And now there are guidelines which are really being standardized. Now, when you are doing training, you need to know your cadre. Whom are you training to perform what roles? And that is where you need really to simplify your training manuals, your guidelines, but not to ignore the quality of care you expect really to be provided. And in most cases, most of our clinical guidelines and all that, which has been revised, is standardized. And also the training, depending on the various cadres you're training, is also simplified to be able to be followed up. And of course, the strict supervision. The supervision mechanism is like mentoring. You just don't go to check whether this is correct or wrong. There's the mentoring kind of supervision where you look at the quality. You can even camp at a place where you think services are not being well provided for 2 to 3 days. Do it together. You see that is being done. We have quite a number of people monitoring for adherence, like people living with HIV and AIDS have been all along in our training. We even label them expert clients because they themselves are on treatment. They know so much that sometimes during the training, when we give the doctors to do practical kind of thing, we give one of these person, the patient, on treatment, and then they take what the doctors mentioned just to see whether the doctor is on the track. Sometimes they will challenge, say, you left out whether I'm on family planning, you're not asking me this, you've left out this and that. Through the medication, I think they become expert themselves. They are good in, for instance, adherence monitoring. They are good in treatment education, treatment literacy. You see the value where each group really come in. Then we've gone training nurses to do clinical staging, and they are able to do it. Because where you find a doctor only initiate on the treatment, that means the thousands of patients who are coming, if there's no doctor, then they'll never be initiated on ART. But you have a clinical officer, a medical assistant, you can train to do that. This is the kind of thing we really looked at in a way whereby simplification of training, yes, supervision for quality, yes, that is indeed happening. And then, of course, ensuring the quality of patient is being done. HIV/AIDS was an entry point because of the demand of care. It doesn't mean that limits it. You're quite right. This is now applied to all. They can manage issues of service delivery, malaria, tuberculosis, and all that. The HIV was just an entry point, so it's not going to be really limited there. And I think that's okay. It.
Good. So thank you very much. I think what the different panelists who have been saying about task shifting is that there are three pillars that needs to be considered when you want to implement successfully task shifting. And the one is, of course, the standardization and simplification of the practice. Two is an initial training, and three, the supervision. I think that's very, very important. And I know that the TB community is certainly among the most experienced professional when it comes to task shifting. You know, we have been very, very much focusing the initial part of this discussion on human resources for health. But when we talk about health systems, which is basically the title of this presentation, we talk about human resources for health for sure, but it's also about infrastructure, it's about health systems financing, it's about information systems, it's about delivery mechanism and management leadership. When we talk about management and leadership, of course, the word has changed. Leadership and management talk very, very much about public-private partnership. So the second part of this presentation will be looking at other elements that constitute health systems in a country. We'll be addressing infrastructure, including lab techniques, but also we'll be addressing how to manage this public and private partnership at country level. At this juncture, I would like to have my panelists to stay with me, please, and ask Linda Pearson from South Africa to talk about public-private partnership for integrated laboratory services strengthening. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's okay. If you want to see the presentation and want to go by the floor, you're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Sam. I'm actually from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, from the International Laboratory Branch, but I actually travel to South Africa quite often. So I would like to change the focus a little bit, as Dr. Sam alluded to, by talking to you about two important initiatives for strengthening lab services. One is the development of national strategic plans in the countries, and the next is public-private partnerships and the value that they bring to strengthening lab services. So we've heard today about the countries that receive direct support from the PEPFAR initiative. And I just want to point out that about half of the world's estimated 33 million HIV-positive people reside within these countries, and about 90% of the world's TB patients who are co-infected with HIV are also from these countries. And focusing on Africa, Africa has about 79% of the global TB cases arising in people with HIV, and the spread is shown in this WHO figure. And TB is responsible for the majority of deaths of patients co-infected with HIV in this part of the world. And what we've been hearing about the activists at the recent HIV conference in Mexico, who were, their slogan was, living with HIV but dying of TB. And it's really preaching to the crowd, or to the choir here, in talking about the association of TB and HIV, where the HIV epidemic has led to the huge increases of the incidence of TB. The treatment is complicated by the negative interactions of the drugs, and TB is more difficult from a laboratory standpoint to diagnose in HIV co-infected because most patients are smear negative, often with reduced pulmonary cavity formation and, unfortunately, a very high mortality rate. And as far as PEPFAR's goal and laboratory systems, it's important to increase the capacity of the labs by building sustainable, integrated, and integrated is a very important word here, laboratory capacity to provide quality diagnostic tests for effective implementation of the programs across diseases, HIV, TB, opportunistic infections. So what are the challenges that are faced in strengthening national lab services? There's many. Laboratory infrastructure, for one. The facilities are often have not been well-maintained. Human resources, training, of course, and quality management, and supply chain management. So some of the effective approaches for building lab capacity is to work in country with the government ministries and also with the national and international public and private partners to establish and implement national strategic plans for the laboratories. And, of course, to use an integrated disease-wide approach, not just focusing on HIV or TB. And to, of course, standardize lab systems through certification and accreditation. And finally, establishing public-private partnerships that can bring many benefits. So to this end, WHO AFRO and several other partners, with a strong support from PEPFAR, organized a conference in Maputo recently in January. And the declaration from that meeting required that national governments should support lab systems as a priority through implementation of a national strategic plan, and to develop those national strategic plans for integrated lab support for the major diseases. So what are the essential components of a national lab strategic plan? To establish minimum standards for lab testing, develop strategies for workforce development and retention, to link the tiered integrated lab services. Many of these services have been parallel or silo systems, but to link them, ensure a continuous supply of lab commodities, establish programs for facility and equipment maintenance, and provide safe work environments, and establish, importantly, to establish roles, responsibilities, and accountability for these activities. Steps in the development and implementation of a National Lab Strategic Plan. So the goal is to establish national quality assured networks of a tiered laboratory services. And in order to do that, it's important to engage the country and the partners in the discussions, to form coordinating and technical committees, develop the plan, implement the plan, and then review and evaluate the progress. So ongoing work in several of the countries has moved through the development of the plans. So as you go from left to right, you see at the top the countries engaged in discussion, then the technical or the committees are formed, the plan is developed, the plan is implemented, and then the plan is reviewed and evaluated, or the progress is reviewed and evaluated. So many of the countries that have been, that our branch and others have been working in, have moved forward quite well with this development of the plan. For instance, in Kenya, a national laboratory policy has been developed, policy guidelines, followed up by how to implement those guidelines with their national strategic plan. And Kenya's strategy towards the integration of the lab services, they have established a laboratory interagency coordinating committee with membership from the different partners and local government organizations. They developed and implemented an integrated lab policy and strategic plan, as I showed you, and they established a central data unit with linkages to the different laboratories, and then they launched an integrated lab curriculum for in-service training for their laboratory staffs. Also in Ethiopia, they have moved forward with developing their national lab strategic plan. They've reviewed it, and this has also served as a model for strengthening the tiered laboratory system within the country by integrating the various TB, malaria, and HIV. And, of course, it's been multiple partners have been involved in this. And focusing on the integrated approach, a new reference laboratory has been built in Addis, and activities within this laboratory will be for HIV, TB, malaria, and avian influenza. Also in Zaria in Nigeria, the National TB and Leprosy Training Center, which has been established for several years, is now used for training not just for TB and leprosy, but also for HIV and also for malaria. There has been an African Center for Integrated Lab Training that has been established in Johannesburg, and this center is providing 1 to 3 week standardized trainings in hands-on lab techniques. This is available for all of the countries in Africa. It's located on the campus of NICD in Johannesburg, and the courses that are being developed and presented have been based on country needs assessment, starting out with TB culture and drug susceptibility testing, DNA PCR for early infant diagnosis of HIV, lab management, commodities management, and a very important biosafety and lab infrastructure. And the power of partnerships, focusing on public-private partnerships. An important component of these partnerships are to ensure sustainability of programs by enhancing capacities of local organizations and increasing access to competencies of the private sector. They facilitate interventions through private sector networks and access target populations through workplace programs. And, of course, an important aspect is their sharing of program costs. There is PEPFAR has initiated a PPP with Becton Dickinson, And this was announced last year in 2007. This is specific for strengthening laboratory programs and working in countries, sharing their strengths, experience, methodologies, and resources, and collaboration with other implementing partners. They have established fellowship programs for their BD staff to work with the ministries of health in the countries, other PEPFAR agencies, and national reference labs. They provide short-term technical assistance for lab training and providing a framework for other levels of service. And there's been a commitment to deploy approximately 25 to 50 BD staff per year. And initially, they have targeted Uganda, Ethiopia, Botswana, and Kenya. Specifically, what they have done so far in Uganda this year, they have worked to establish a training program on CD4 count quality management. They have worked on training programs also for TB smear microscopy and come up with a method of methodologies, procedures for TB specimen management and referral, and also established a partnership with several in-country partners who are already working there. Likewise, the Abbott Fund has established a PPP in Tanzania and building Tanzania's lab capacity through a PPP, with several partners involved in this in addition to the Abbott Fund. The partners have collaborated to modernize several laboratories within Tanzania. There have been responsibilities for the different partners. The Ministry of Health and Social Welfare and CDC have been responsible for coordination of partners and for laboratory expertise. And the Abbott Fund in Tanzania has been responsible for the renovation, project management, and the funding for the modernization of 23 labs. APHL, or the Association of Public Health Labs, has provided technical assistance in design and planning. And then a nonprofit initiative of an engineering firm from the U.S., D4O, has provided lab design, planning, and implementation. So far, the Mount Meru Hospital has been modernized, and this modernized lab has increased the capacity of this lab to 150 patients per day, and a provision of a much wider variety of tests, array of tests. And this new technical capacity has allowed the lab to safely manage some more highly infectious agents. And they've provided more automated assays, which have improved accuracy and decreased the turnaround time. So ongoing Abbott Fund activities, they are working now to modernize more labs within the country, regional labs, provide training for the staff and testing and care, and also providing a large number of HIV rapid tests. So in conclusion, some of the cornerstones for strengthening lab capacity, some that I've focused on today, are to develop sustainable lab systems using lab strategic planning within the country, promote the integration of infectious disease laboratories so that you don't have separate laboratories for each disease, encourage public-private partnerships, and important, to coordinate partner efforts and build synergies among them. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very, very much, Linda, for this excellent presentation. I think this is certainly the type of best practices that people would like to see, basically using some PEPFAR program to, one, push for integration. Integration is key. Two, push for public-private partnership. I think that is definitely the type of best practice that we would like to see replicated all over the world. So I will not open the floor for discussion, and what I will do is just we proceed with the two other presentations, then I will ask the presenters to come here and then answer to the question from the floor. So without any delay, I will then call upon Margot from South Africa to come and talk about the That's It integrated TB HIV care program, basically looking at bridging programs and strengthening health systems. So the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for this opportunity to discuss with you some of our experiences in That's It, the integrated TB-HIV care program. Just as a starting point, let's just look at some of the relevant TB statistics in South Africa. These are averages, not the latest statistics, unfortunately, but we don't believe that it will change a lot, maybe just the number of MDR-TB cases that are reported. So the important thing here is to remember that South Africa is a high TB burden country. TB incidence ranges from 500 to 1,500 in some districts per 100,000 population. Reported cases in the range of 350,000 per year, with a treatment success rate of about low 50s, 54% plus, and completion rate of high 60s. The important thing here is also to remember that HIV co-infection rate in TB patients is high. It ranges from 30 to about 75%, with an average of 55%. And as you can see, we've got reported last in 2006, 6,000 MDR-TB cases, but there is reason to believe that this number has increased dramatically over the last year. Now, how does it look like TB and HIV services in South Africa? TB is the most common cause of HIV-related morbidity and mortality, and unfortunately is characterized by parallel services and funding at facility care level and service care delivery, not so much at the policy making level. There's a high TB-HIV co-infection rate, and unfortunately the dual epidemic aggravates the stigma associated with the diseases. So the burden of HIV prevention falls largely on the TB program, and the lack of integrated services forms a barrier to care for co-infected patients. So what is That's It? First of all, it's an acronym for TB, HIV, AIDS, Treatment, Support, and Integrated Therapy. It's a best practice approach, and it aims to access integrated TB-HIV care for patients that is easy, efficient, appropriate, and cost-effective. It was a model-based approach that was developed in KwaZulu-Natal, Midlands, in a TB hospital 2 years ago, and basically it's a public-private merger or partnership with implementation by the South African Medical Research Council, the Department of Health in the various provinces, and private partners like Life Isidimeni, the Foundation for Professional Development, or World Vision. It's PEPFAR funded through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So what is our operational framework? First of all, it is a one-stop service for TB and HIV-positive patients. That is our objective. So what does it do? It provides HIV counseling and testing that is preferably provided, initiated with TB as the entry point to services. As HIV, as entry point of service, we provide regular TB screening for HIV-positive patients. There's a very strong clinical care component, including prophylaxis, referrals, nutrition, treatment of opportunistic infections, and antiretroviral treatment where indicated, with a strong HR focus. Obviously, we have to give our attention to infection control practices and providing and including infrastructure where necessary, with a very strong community outreach component to address not only the dual stigma, but also to educate patients, healthcare workers, and the community at large. And this forges then linkages and makes sure that the follow-up of our patients is effective. In terms of health systems, we look at patient management systems, trying to identify the bottlenecks and iron them out, look at data capturing, recording, and reporting, and overall to improve patient flow systems and overall infection control and patient delivery, care delivery. This is just a picture of our model site that was initiated in 2005 in a TB hospital in KwaZulu-Natal Midlands. I think the important thing here to look at is that our positive findings that we are busy writing up at the moment is that there was a decrease in patient mortality, dramatic decrease from about 35% in the general TB patients in the hospital to less than 10%, and there was a very low incidence of adverse drug side effects after the early introduction of antiretrovirals to TB patients on TB medication. The expansion sites started in about the last quarter of 2006, and as you can see, we are in the periphery at the deep rural resource-limited areas of South Africa, near the Botswana border there in the northwest province, Bray Boporima district, near the Mozambique border in Kumasi in Mpumalanga, near the Lesotho border in KwaZulu-Natal, in 8 TB hospitals throughout the Eastern Cape and at the Eastern Cape-Western Cape border in the Eden district down here, the bottom of the Western Cape. Now, people often ask me, what does an integrated clinic look like? And we put a lot of thought about it and thought, what is the process that we go through if we go to a clinic and do a needs assessment? And we've come up with the following 10 stations of TB-HIV integrated care. Our first station is the station where the patient, the TB patient, is provided with counseling and testing. And linked to that, there's a station of the TB screening to the patient that already knows the HIV status. Then in the middle here, we've got our central station of clinical care where wellness, prevention, and TB treatment is given with a strong focus on infection control as well as recording and reporting, and very important here, the integration of files, because we believe if the files are integrated, then also the care is integrated. On the top right there and the bottom left here, we've got our community linkages and our training. That is pervasive programs that have to reach out to each other. So we do TB training not only for our healthcare workers, but also into the community through our community outreach programs, and then linked up with our nutritional gardens that are either linked up to clinics or to the communities. Obviously, because we treat patients, we have to look at the pharmacy component and how and when antiretrovirals are given. We try and decant the antiretrovirals to the peripheral clinics, even if we need to introduce mobile clinics, and then through our TB traces, link it back to our clinical care component, which obviously happens at the periphery in TB care. So just summing it up in another way, what does that provide? It provides human resources, infrastructure when necessary, equipment, either medical or office equipment. We have a strong community outreach component, introducing mobile clinics where necessary, with the infection control focus. We look at systems trying to improve patient flow system, decrease patient waiting times and clinical care. We have our data capturing and IT component, training, including nutrition and nutrition gardens, and then our technical support, which is TB as well as laboratory. So just some of the challenges and successes in our program. This is one of the big challenges in our program. In the Northwest, very often patients have to travel 200-plus kilometers to the nearest antiretroviral site. And our TB clinics, anything from 50 to 100 kilometers, with very little traffic except maybe this or even this. And if you're lucky, this is the only public transport that is available. Another big challenge is the communication, the telecommunications, very poor connectivity, internet access is very unstable, so that's a real challenge to overcome. And this all leads to overcrowding of waiting rooms and waiting times. This is one of the really important aspects that we had to give attention to. So what did we provide? Infrastructure. We try to ensure that there's infrastructure to provide the services and to provide integrated care, and also provide the HR link to that. As you can see here in this area, this we provided outside waiting area, so to reduce the overcrowding in the waiting rooms. And then we introduced a simple numbering system for patients so that we can reduce the number of patients in waiting rooms. This is one of the other things that we provided was ultraviolet lights for the infection control, but I must stress that this is not the only component in terms of infection control that we give attention to. We have policies and procedures in place, open window policies, simple things like that, and also extraction fans to ensure that the ventilation is in place. Now, if we go back to our 10 stations, this is our first and second station, our VCT and screening. You can see on the left is our very enthusiastic HIV counselor. She has designed a hat there of condoms, and this is one of the ways how she gives education. But if that is not possible, we go out into the communities, the picture on the right there, where we actually give the counseling testing in the community itself. This is the team in Khanyisa Hospital in the far northwest. On the right, there's the medical manager from the Khanyisa Hospital, from the department. With the middle person is our pharmacist, and left is our medical officer. But integrated care, if we talk integrated care, we also have to talk of integrated teams. This is very important to ensure that quality care is given and that patient can access all treatment at the same place. And this is obviously to ensure that there is patient satisfaction and happiness and quality of care. One of our aspects that we concentrate on, as I mentioned before, is the integrated filing system, ensuring that there is one file per patient, and we also ensure that there is a systematic, a forms-based approach to seeing the patients. This is just an example of the forms that we've introduced to ensure that patient care is given in a standardized way. This is the gardener in our middle of the Kalahari Desert up there in Bray border at the Botswana border. He has started the garden there, and I can promise you if it works there, it can work anywhere in the world. And this is another example of our nutrition gardens, this time in KwaZulu-Natal at a homestead at home. You can see there is no water, no running water available. They have to fetch the water either from the dam down there, and there is a communal tap, but also quite a while away. But this, what the picture here shows, the TB tracer there on the right, and then the patient there on the left. This is our peripheral clinics that are serviced by mobiles to bring the antiretrovirals to the patient, and this is the team that is associated with that. On the right, the TB tracers, as we call them, in the Eden District in the Western Cape. They go out physically on foot, visit their patients. They can do it there in that district because it's not so far, the distances are not so far. Obviously, in the northwest, that is not possible, and we use a different model there. This is another picture of the Eden District and the community outreach, HIV counseling and testing and TB screening that is done in the community itself. Training, we put a lot of emphasis on training and capacity building. On the left and the top, the managers in the That's It program. On the bottom, the counselors and community members. And then on the right, there are also some technical trainings there. In terms of laboratory support, basically we give support logistics, courier services, but in the KwaZulu-Natal laboratory we've also provided some equipment to ensure that there's a microscopy service available in a very busy outlying clinic. This is how we address stigma, trying to do it by positive branding and by community outreach programs like this, World TB Day in 2007. This is World TB Day in 2008 at Kudungwane, also in the deep northwest province. You can see the whole community is involved with this. This was one of the communities where we found that we had a higher rate of MDR TB patients, and we wanted to educate the community. We also had a fun walk for children, and it was very well attended. This is another community outreach, this time in the Eastern Cape, and this time in Peter in the Western Cape, where we again involved the children in a fun walk and trying to educate children about TB and HIV, and in this way also then getting through to the parents. This is the calendar that we produced in the previous year, and I can just show you that this is our 2009 calendar. Children took part in an art competition. The whole Plettenberg Bay Beta was involved with that. It happened in all three languages, the competition, and they all got prizes for that. And then the result is a calendar that we distribute to communities and hospitals where necessary. Just some of the project statistics. This is just to show how many patients benefited from this project. But I'd rather like to go to some of the ETR.net statistics. I just have to point out that in Boperima there are about 24 clinics. We've been allocated 5 clinics that we're active in, the ones with the worst TB outcomes. So this is just to look and see what has it had any the program any impact on the TB treatment indicators. Now, we started in the latter quarter of 2006, and one can see here the TB treatment outcome was about 34% in 2006, and it has risen now in end of 2006-2007 to just over 50%. And this trend hopefully will continue, but it's still early days. If we look at case finding, which is a quicker indicator, we can see sort of the same trend. Potchefstroom, we only started this year, so there's not much difference yet. But in Boparima, we started in 2007 really being very active, and one can see how the TB case finding has increased there, as well as in Molapur, and as well as in Moses Kutana, where it's increased there dramatically. This is just to look at the percentage of TB and HIV in our patients. So this is the actual numbers. This is the percentages. 2007, Buito is in the Western Cape. Boparima is in the Northwest Province. And this, we can see there's a 26% of all our patients, TB patients, were HIV positive in Buito, 65% in Boparima. And this matches more or less the antenatal statistics that are available for these provinces. The same applies in 2008, 25% there in Buito, 45% in Boparima. Now, if you look at TB screening, because this is one of the aspects of our program that we try to emphasize and focus on, in Bray, this is at the Botswana border, very small little town, not many patients there, but we see in 2006, 43 patients were HIV tested, 39 were screened, of which TB, 14 were identified with TB. 2007, when the project started being active there, we tested 150 patients, 143 were screened for TB. This is using a specific TB screening tool, 5 questions, history of TB, night sweats, fever, loss of weight, coughing, that sort of thing. And we identified 51 patients positive TB, so that's roughly a third of the patients that were tested for HIV. And the same pattern applies. Also 51 patients up to September 2008, which we tested and screened 141 patients. My last slide here, Moses Kutane, this is the district near Sun City. Again, when we started there, 51 clinics involved in this district. We are only involved in 14, the ones with the worst TB outcomes. And we can see in 2006 here, of the almost 4,000 patients HIV tested, 136 were screened for TB, of which 56 were confirmed TB. And when we started getting involved there, the number of patients that were screened for TB rose to about 1,000, and 355 were then identified TB. And the same pattern sort of applied in the first 9 months of 2008. So what has That's It got to say? I think we've learned that this is one patient. It may be two diseases. It might be more. It might be diabetes associated with it, other STIs. But we should provide one solution and one location. And the only way to do that is to have one healthcare worker and one file. And I'd like to thank our collaborators, especially the CDC and PEPFAR funds and the Medical Research Council. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Margot, for this very good presentation. And while listening to you, I was tempted really to change your That's It to That's Fantastic. What you have been really presenting was very, very, very exciting. So, Stephanie, you have a challenge. Your challenge is that, if you want to allow presentation, allow discussion after this presentation, it's up to you. So, Stephanie will be talking about commodities, and we have been talking about public-private partnership. We have been talking about human resource for health systems financing, but the supply chain is a key element of health systems, and Stephanie will show us how a targeted supply chain management that is designed for HIV can have implication on the broader health system. So, Stephanie, it's up to you.
Thank you, Badara. Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to share with you some of SCMS's experience in strengthening health system while working at improving the supply chain for HIV/AIDS commodities. I would like to briefly start by giving you some background on what SCMS does. First of all, SCMS stands for Supply Chain Management System. It's a project which was created in 2005 under PEPFAR, and as you can see on this slide, our mission is to strengthen or eventually establish secure, reliable, cost-effective and sustainable supply chains to meet the care and treatment needs of people living with or affected by HIV and AIDS. And to achieve that mission, we both procure and deliver HIV/AIDS medicines and supplies at the best value possible. So that means we need to reach a balance between prices and quality. And we also provide technical assistance to transform supply chain performance. SCMS is primarily dedicated to serve PEPFAR programs, but we are also working with non-PEPFAR recipients, such as the Global Fund Principal recipients and governments. Now SCMS is quite a big team. We have more than 350 dedicated staff around the world. It's a consortium of 16 organizations. I'm not going to list all of them, but I'm sure you know many of them, such as GSI, MSH, IDS Solutions, Crohn Agents. And we have our program management office in the U.S., but we have also in-country presence in and offices in the 15 PEPFAR-focused countries, as well as Zimbabwe. I was very pleased to hear you, Badara, say that supply chain is very important. That's indeed essential for the provision of health services and one of the key components of the health system. Therefore, we certainly realize that our mission will be fulfilled most effectively when all health systems are being made stronger. And we have actually identified four approaches through which we can contribute to strengthening health system. The first approach is about improving the skills of the workers in the health system. By increasing the number of health workers who are adequately and appropriately trained, we create a workforce of in-country experts who are able to manage and maintain supply chains long after SCMS and PEPFAR are gone. So far, we've conducted extensive trainings of pharmacists, but also staff from the Ministry of Health, staff from national structures such as central warehouses and central medical stores, on a variety of topics such as forecasting, logistic management information system, warehousing, distribution, procurement, quality assurance. And of course, the basic tenets of those trainings are applying to all health commodities, not only to HIV/AIDS commodities. The second approach is to build sound infrastructure. And I'm not referring here to construction work, but for example, to creating more capacity space in warehouse, establishing shelving, creating cold chain facilities, ventilations, temperature security, etc. In many countries, SCMS works with institutions that have the responsibility for managing whole health products that come into the system. And when we improve the infrastructure of those institutions, we actually help improving a structure for whole the health products that are being managed in those institutions. The third approach is to create access to health commodities. To meet the health needs, the countries need to improve their forecasting so that the people that are in charge of procurement and the supply of commodities can make the necessary arrangement to ensure that the patients and the programs receive a continuous supply of essential medicines and health products. Without a well-planned procurement, you risk to face stockouts, emergency purchase, or even over-purchasing. So we try to help our client to develop professional and planned procurement so that they can focus on their core mission, which is to manage the healthcare programs and to treat the patients, rather than spending unnecessary time pursuing the commodities that they need. And finally, the fourth approach is to adopt effective practices for health logistics. Only a fully functioning distribution system will allow a rapid, regular, and reliable supply of commodities and will support health services. And by distribution system, I mean here an appropriate planning of deliveries, but also the appropriate technology, the appropriate storage, and of course the appropriate transport. Besides, the orders of medicines needs to be filled on time and in full to build the confidence and the full participation in the system by all, meaning the funders, the program managers, the clinicians, and the patients. Following those four approaches, the benefits from SCMS investments and initiatives often extend beyond HIV/AIDS to the health sector in general. But I would like to illustrate this statement with a few concrete country examples. And I will start with Guyana, where SCMS supports the Ministry of Health Materials Management Unit, which manages the procurement and distribution of all public sectors and donated health commodities. In particular, we have provided support to develop and enhance warehousing and distribution system for all the commodities that were managed at the MMU. And we have, among other things, helped put in place an upgraded logistic management information system. This included the implementation of a warehouse management system for an improved storage, inventory, and information management within the warehouse. But we are also in the process of developing and testing what we call an electronic combined requisition inventory voucher, which will allow the facility to place their order directly into the warehouse management system at the MMU. And thanks to those upgrades, today Guyana has the most advanced warehouse management system in the Caribbean, a system which benefits all health commodities being managed at country level. Collaboration is another area which one can use to have a broader impact on health systems. And again, in Guyana, the World Bank, Global Fund, PEPFAR, and more recently UNITAID have joined their efforts under the Ministry of Health's leadership to improve the coordination of procurement planning for ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, and other HIV/AIDS commodities. And in view of the positive achievements of that initiative, the donors led by the Ministry of Health have invited the TB and malaria programs to actually join the initiative and apply the same process to other health commodities. And in that regard, SCMS has trained staff from the TB and malaria program into procurement and supply management tools for the development of forecasting and supply plannings. And in other words, the experience and the expertise in the use of those tools was shared to build the capacity of other programs that are dealing with other very serious diseases. Moving now to Mozambique. In Mozambique, we work with CIMAM, which is the Central de Medicamento e Artigos Médicos. This is within the Ministry of Health Department in charge of procurement, importation, warehousing, and distribution of all the medicines that are being used within the public health system. The warehousing and distribution functions were formerly handled by a parastatal organization named MEDIMOC, but it's been transferred back to CIMAM earlier this year at the request of the Ministry of Health. However, CIMAM did not have any experience in the area of warehousing. So SCMS has been asked to help CIMAM with the transition and to support them develop a warehousing plan. Previously, MEDIMOC had organized the warehousing of the central level stock across 11 different locations throughout Maputo. And when we started the assessment of those different warehouses, we quickly realized that this was a very inefficient way of managing warehousing of central level stocks. So with USAID Deliver and with CIMAM, of course, we've worked on a plan to consolidate the 11 locations into three plan locations. And this is just the beginning, because ultimately there will be a single and unique location in Maputo for the central level stock. However, already with this three location consolidation step, we've seen better and more efficient management of stock, and we've managed to achieve an improvement of the distribution of all the medicines in the country. And finally, Rwanda. In Rwanda, we work with the Government Coordinated Procurement Distribution System, CPDS, which is a coordination mechanism for HIV/AIDS commodities. And we have the responsibility to provide technical assistance to CPDS for the forecasting and supply planning of all HIV/AIDS commodities, which includes ARVs, but also drugs for opportunistic infections, test kits, lab commodities, and also TB commodities for the management of TB HIV co-infections. And the staff that have been trained were actually coming from different local organizations and institutions involved in CPDS. For example, they were coming from the National AIDS Control Program, but also from CAMERWA, which is the National Pharmaceutical Procurement Agency, or the Pharmacy Task Force within the Ministry of Health, or the National Reference Laboratory, etc. And all those staff are now able to apply the methodologies and the principle of forecasting and supply planning of HIV/AIDS commodities to the other health products that they are managing in the broader context of their activities outside of CPDS. And I will finish talking a little bit about logistic management information system, because in Rwanda, there are many different LMIS which coexist for different categories of commodities. HIV/AIDS, TB, malaria, essential medicines, family planning, and this is really a burden for health workers. SCMS was tasked to help improve the LMIS for HIV/AIDS commodities, but in spite of building a stronger but isolated LMIS, SCMS, in collaboration with USAID Deliver, decided to work at strengthening a national unique LMIS, national LMIS, that would handle all health commodities being used in country. Of course, this is not something that happens overnight, and this is still in working progress. It involves all the stakeholders in country and a lot of harmonization workshop to achieve this. But what's interesting here is that the improvements of the HIV/AIDS LMIS was actually the starting point of a broader effort to rationalize existing multiple parallel systems into one common and consolidated national LMIS for all the commodities. And I'd like to conclude by saying that, yes, interventions specific to HIV/AIDS can raise all boats in the health system. If we work with and if we strengthen existing national system and structure, and if we foster collaboration among the international and national stakeholders. As the example that I've just described have shown, there has been some positive impact of HIV/AIDS intervention, but we need to develop further efforts to leverage HIV/AIDS intervention, and maybe we could have a more coordinated and integrated approach to ensure that strengthening health system is entirely part of a strategy. We also need to develop further effort to more widely share best practices and lessons learned across the different programs to benefit all health commodities. And thank you very much. I'm not sure I...
Thank you so much. As you have noticed, we have basically run over the time, but I will allow 5 minutes. I'll just take the liberty to ask the presenters, Linda, Margot, and Stephanie, just to come here and and take 1, 2, or 3 questions. So I have seen a hand over there, another one. Okay, so please introduce yourself first.
I'm Christian Gunneberg from the Stop TB department in Geneva, WHO. And I was wanting to ask from the What's It program, it seems that you're finding quite a lot of cases of TB amongst those that are diagnosed with HIV. And I'm wondering if that is because they're coming from the peripheral to the center. I'm assuming the TB-HIV collaboration is happening in the centers where there is HIV, ART, provision. Is that right? It's more in the centralized, or is it more peripherally in all the centers that provide TB? I was just wondering what your view was on why you're finding such a high number of TB cases amongst those with HIV? Is it late presentation or something else?
Okay. I think there are two other questions before I give the floor to the speakers. Yes, sir. Can you introduce yourself first? Can you take the mic as well? And you prepare your good. That's wonderful.
I am Josiah Ndrovo from Zambia, and my question goes again to That's It program. Would like to learn a few lessons from you, because we are working on more or less the same program about the TB, HIV, what the approaches to the way we take TB and HIV. With HIV, I think we tend to do a bit of science, even to the most illiterate person who understand how the virus is working in their body and how the ARVs work. We try to make people understand how the virus works. Maybe that's why there is more adherence to drugs for or to ARVs. But for TB, the approach seems to be different. How differently are you working on this program? Or what is the approach so that people are more adherent also to the TB drugs?
Okay. Thank you so much. Yeah, madam.
Thank you to all the presenters. I'm Sipiwe Mdaweni from South Africa, the TAS TB project. My question is directed to Margo Ace. The That's It program seems to be very comprehensive and elaborate, basically providing all that which a patient needs to live a good quality of life. My concern is always around sustainability and continuity, that what's going to happen if the program is finding cease. Are the measures that are put in place to ensure that this is continued to further contribute to health system strengthening? And also my other concern is around skills transfer. When you do the training, do you also invite the whole district to ensure that other healthcare workers benefit from the training that you provide?
Thank you. And the last question.
Okay, my name is Yared Kabede from the Program Management Unit of TBCAP at KNCV. My question is also related to the South Africa integration to Marco. One issue is that you try to integrate the recording and monitoring of the two diseases, but in most countries they have...
Yeah.
Sorry. But in most countries there are parallel two programs. And you have to have separate records or at least registers. So how did you manage with that? The other question is, you had quite good screening in some of the settings. So what was the barrier for not implementing IPT?
Okay, thank you. And the very, very last question comes from this gentleman from, yeah.
Hello, I'm Dr. Peter Mgosha from Tanzania. My question goes to Margot. And this one is regarding to infection control. As we all know that screening of HIV patient TB clinics, it's easier. But somehow it's very difficult to screen people in the care and treatment center. As I can see from your supermarket approach, I mean, that is it. How do you go with that one so that you can share with us to see how much we can learn that good practice from your country? Thank you.
Thank you so much for all those who ask questions. I think people tend to ask questions to Margaret, but I see that the questions that you have asked are relevant to the three presentations. So I will ask them all to react to those. So I'll start with Margaret.
I hope I can remember all the questions. First of all, the one that comes first is the training. We do training for all the healthcare workers in that district that we support. So it's not only directed for the That's It team. In terms of sustainability, we're very careful in not appointing many staff members. We try and be very conservative with that, trying to build capacity from the staff that are there, from the healthcare departments of health themselves. Very often the positions are available in the Department of Health structure, but they have just been frozen for some certain reasons or whatever. So it is a temporary hindrance from their part. So I think the sustainability ones these funds are not available will continue because the department will take over. And of course, very important is that one has collaboration at all levels of the department so that they're aware of the position that you want to employ the people in or what you want to do. Infrastructure, obviously, that is, you know, that has been done and that will carry on. So I think that's the issue with the sustainability. Then in terms of how do we do it differently, we work at the periphery, at the TB clinic. So we bring the antiretrovirals to the periphery. So and we also work at the district hospital from that district. So trying, because very often we cannot get accreditation immediately, that's a long process, but if we do decanting of sable patients, that we can do immediately to the periphery. So that's why we've got those mobile clinics, so that those sable patients can then access the antiretrovirals at the periphery where they get the TB medication. I think the success of the program is, it has to do also with basically what the HIV program also does is to really concentrate on patient care and a good relationship between healthcare worker and the patient. And through that, working through with the education of the patient and also making the communities then aware. The community outreach program, I think, is very important to get the communities to understand and buy in and then making sure that they patients then adhere to their treatment. So just in terms of the question from Zambia, I think it was. Then in terms of the statistics recording and reporting, in South Africa, there's also two separate recording systems. I think this is one of the hindrances of integrated care. But we are working towards, with the National Health Laboratory System, towards a patient management system that is integrated, and it's also a PEPFAR-funded system that will be developed eventually. But that's in the early stages. If I say integrated care, I talk about working together with the ETR.net, getting our statistics that we need from just the basic Excel spreadsheet for PEPFAR funding purposes, getting them together and make sure that they match. I think that was all the questions that I can remember.
Yeah. We
adhere to what the province does in the area. If the province's policy is not to implement IPT, then we don't go ahead. We have to adhere because we teamwork. We do teamwork with the province. We can't do our own thing.
Thank you, Margaret. Then I will allow half a minute to Stephanie and Linda. So.
Okay, maybe I'll just react very quickly on the question related to separate reports. I think it's indeed a challenge for the implementers in general to have to deal with different constraints and requirements from different donors, but I think it's our role, all as we are on the field and donors and governments, to all work together and to coordinate our efforts to try and establish systems that accommodate those requirements and different constraints. It is possible. We need to be creative, and we need to establish mechanisms and tools that allows the collection of data that are important for all of us. And I think that in the area of supply chain management, there is also a lot to do in terms of trying and better bridge TB and HIV. And there are also a lot of reports to manage supply chains that we need to better integrate.
I'll just comment briefly about diagnostic screening, laboratory screening of TB patients for HIV or vice versa. It is much easier to screen TB patients for HIV because of the use of the rapid tests. However, screening HIV patients for TB has more challenges. There is no nice rapid test for TB. The current assay is smear microscopy, although there have been some great improvements in that by use of or development of better fluorescent microscopes, less expensive and so improving the sensitivity. However, many HIV positive individuals do not have have a negative smear. So in the past 2 or 3 years, there have been much much more activities and research into newer point of care assays for TB. And we hope that we're not there yet, but we've heard a lot of information at this meeting and in the literature about newer assays that are under development now, and hopefully it will there will be something in the near future for that. There are new assays now, including the new molecular test, that, but they are at the reference lab level. And so we don't yet have a good assay for point of care, but hopefully we will get there.
Okay, thank you, Linda. Now it's definitely time to close this session, so I will not go into a big wrap-up, but I would just say that I'm sure that everybody here in this room will concur that this session has really has participated significantly in bringing more light in the current, in the ongoing debate on positive synergies between global health initiatives and health systems. And I would just to close by asking all of you to basically to applaud Caroline, Elizabeth, Wessler, Linda, Margot, and Stephanie for a wonderful presentation and wonderful debate. Thank you.